The last word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Now, we're continuing our major 10-part series, The State of Trump's Union, for The Last Word, which, of course, we're on episode 4 now. We've been talking to and will continue to talk to a variety of people with intelligent and informed and differing views about the United States, where it is now politically, culturally, socially and economically. Its place in the world, where there are divisions, where there's unity, the dangers it's facing, the hopes that our guests have for the country's future, and where power lies and how it's used. And I'm delighted today we have a voice that we haven't met previously on The Last Word here at Today FM. Janae Hartaux is the former Minneapolis Chief of Police. And we're delighted to have an expert on policing with us, given that policing has been such a major issue in the United States going back for many years, but particularly this year as well. And this year, many of the major protests from the Black Lives Matter movement have been very much prompted by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis on the 25th of May. Janae, thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Last Word of Today FM. But can I start by asking you about the difficulties that policing poses in the United States? That it seems to many of us on this side of the Atlantic that there's a real problem in getting people to buy into the police as their protectors, that they see many people in the United States seem to see the police as almost something of the enemy.
Yeah, one of the greatest challenges we've had over decades, yes, is police legitimacy and our ability to ensure that we have adequate resources to manage crime and disorder in our communities, but at the same time, building relationships and ensuring that people understand the inner workings of police work, how things get done, how communities, frankly, have a very strong role in policing their own neighborhoods and ensuring that they can communicate with their first responders.
But there seems to be almost a confrontational approach from what we hear, particularly in major urban areas, between the police and elements of American society. When I say elements, I mean people who maybe come from impoverished backgrounds, who come from minorities, that there seems to be an adversarial, violent, confrontational approach.
Well, historically, people of color, of course, have less socioeconomic statuses, live in impoverished areas in which we have the greatest crime. And then our police officers are patrolling those areas most often, and they are only seeing police officers in some of the most critical crisis situations and not when things are good. And so there's this perception of policing that is more in line with violence and responsiveness in those neighborhoods. And so there's a multitude of things that need to occur in order to change those perceptions. One is having experiences outside of a crisis with a police officer. So there's many things that we're trying to do in policing to ensure that those things happen. But of course, right now, politically, things are drawn and there's quite a division between those who want to peacefully protest and demonstrate and express their anger and frustration over the killing of George Floyd and other black men at the hands of police. And then there's the other side who feels that violence and anarchy is the way to go and that we shouldn't be helping to facilitate that freedom of speech. And we really need to have two different responses for those groups of people.
Well, I'll get back to that in a moment. But it seems that in many parts of the United States, you're nine times as likely to be arrested or to get into a confrontational situation with a police officer if you come from a minority community or come from an impoverished background. Does that create an impression amongst many people in the United States that with the policing service you receive as a citizen of the state or even as a non-citizen depends very much on your color of your skin and your socioeconomic status?
Well, again, it goes back to our highest crime areas are where police are patrolling the most. And unfortunately, there's an unintended consequence, and that is those people of color that may be in those neighborhoods that may match the description of the suspect in the shooting might be stopped. and something else might be found about that person. They don't have a driver's license. Maybe they have some narcotics on them, whatever it might be. And because of the fact that police are in those neighborhoods more frequently, your chances of being stopped. So it's this vicious cycle. And so it's not just it's not just a policing issue. Frankly, it's a societal issue that stems back many years.
And then are crime levels higher in those areas by legitimate count rather than just literally a targeting effect? Is it the case that you do have greater issues with drug use and associated crime in areas of deprivation?
Yes. And then, of course, now with the addition of COVID-19 across the globe, people are losing their jobs. We have more and more folks who are turning to alcohol and drugs to not only medicate themselves, but also to earn money. Robberies are up. Homicide is increased. And so we're just adding fuel to the fire and continue to not address the systemic issues in those neighborhoods.
Yeah, how difficult is it to police when you have a country which does seem to be in the grip of an opioid crisis and other drugs seemingly been available and used throughout American society in great volume?
Right. It's very challenging. And one of the things I've been pushing for a long time are some national standards. We have over 18,000 individual police departments in the United States. I think it's too many. I think we should regionalize more. We should have, departments that are larger that cover more areas, and we can have consistency in our practices and uses of force and how we police across the board. So it's left up to, many of it is left up to individual cities, requirements, hiring requirements, how people are held accountable. It really varies across the country.
You feature prominently in a major new documentary, Women in Blue, which is being shown here in Ireland as part of the IFI Documentary Festival, which is running until the 27th of September. And there are full details of that on ifihome.ie. But I was very taken in watching the documentary, just even at the outset of it, how white the Minneapolis police force certainly was at the time when you joined it. Now, in your years as chief of police, how successful were you in actually making the police force more representative of the community it's meant to serve?
I was able to increase our percentages slightly in both hiring women and people of color. We were very focused on doing those two things. I believe that we should have, police departments that are reflective of the communities that we serve. But I will say one of our greatest challenges in having that diversity is not just in hiring practices, which I think we do need to address, but in the perception of policing, what we just talked about. And so if there's this perception that the police are the enemy and they're not there to truly serve and protect, then it is going to be more difficult and challenging to be able to hire those that are people of color. Also, in the state of Minnesota, where I'm from, we do have educational requirements, and many people, of course, in poverty cannot afford college tuition, so we worked on programs to pay for their tuition, and if they could successfully complete the program, they would automatically then have a position with the Minneapolis Police Department. So there are many initiatives at play, but this is, decades of underserved population having to try to change the mindset, and it takes time to move the needle even slightly. It is still very much a male-dominated Caucasian profession. There's no doubt about it.
And then how much of the resistance comes from within the police force itself? I think you have a union chief, for example, in Minneapolis, Bob Kroll, who has a rather, troubled history when it comes in relation to allegations of racial abuse, and who on the killing of George Floyd described him as a violent criminal, as if somebody having once had some sort of prison sentence legitimized the use of excessive force and even killing somebody.
Yes, unions in America are a constant impediment to change and police reform. Certainly within the Minneapolis Police Department, Bob Kroll himself had been on the union as an officer for 24 years. And when you're trying to have police reform, change culture, which I was a a large portion of my tenure as police chief was to change the culture and be progressive in police reform. You have a resistor who frankly has more time and will outlast the police chief. And so that becomes very challenging, and he can speak for the rank and file. And all people certainly don't agree with him, but the general public believes that his view is what the police officer's view. And it makes it very challenging for the police chief to lead, hold people accountable, and to have them act in the manner in which we would like them to.
What about the politicization of policing in the United States this year in particular, as we're in the election cycle? What do you make of that and the damage it might do?
It's extremely damaging. I absolutely believe that we should reinvent policing. We've gotten to this place where there's too many types of calls and issues that police are expected to address, such as mental health, and they're just not adequately prepared to do that. But the concept of defunding and taking away resources will take away reform, because the only thing that our officers will be able to do is respond to 911 calls. And you won't have the progressive training. You won't be able to diversify the police departments. You won't be able to continue to participate in all the initiatives that help in building community and police relationships. And you won't be able to pay for the different technologies we need, like body cameras and data collection. Right before I left as chief, one of the things we were looking at was how many people of color were being stopped, where were they stopped, why were they being stopped. So we just began to really track that data to look at, are there patterns of misbehavior, implicit bias training. Those things cost money. And so having the political framework at the highest level in the United States is very challenging when it becomes the us versus them. And we have to have community trust and support and police legitimacy to have safe neighborhoods. It's an absolute must.
Jeanette, the documentary Women in Blue also highlights how when you were in charge of the Minneapolis police force, you had a similar incident to the George Floyd one, which has caught international attention since May. How did you deal with the previous incident, and why did the George Floyd one, do you think, become something different and become just more public?
Well, the incident I had was certainly not caught on body camera or videotape, and was actually a justified use of force, although it was tragic and it still ended in deadly use of force. It's challenging. But when everybody in the world was able to see the 8 minutes and 46 seconds of somebody laying on the ground and having an officer's knee pressed on his neck, very casual, you just really see, I think it was on display for the world to see, just how much this officer devalued George Floyd's life. None of us know if it was in fact because he was African American, but it's really hard to argue that that wasn't the case. We also were able to provide two different spaces, one for people to peacefully demonstrate and protest, and another we had to address the more violent groups in a different manner. But I do think that George Floyd was so long and was so hard for people to watch. It really highlighted systemic racism in this country and across the world, and no longer allowed people who had privilege to sit back and say, that's just an incident. That's just one person. That's just one officer. And so I think that is the fundamental difference.
You mentioned the word privilege there. Privilege seems to be one of the sort of the buzzwords of the culture wars in the United States at present. What do you mean by the word privilege?
Those of us who don't have to worry about our next meal or being treated disparately by the police department and officers and looked upon differently or less than. And that's certainly not everybody. And 99% of police officers are outstanding, honorable, great men and women. But there, of course, is a fraction of police officers, just like there is in society, in which people decide that you are less than or equal to them based on your race, based on your socioeconomic status. I would say you'd see the same things with the homeless population. And so those are constant challenges we have here in America.
Another constant challenge that you have, which gets an enormous amount of attention here on this side of the Atlantic, is the propensity to use guns, the extraordinary number of guns in circulation,
yes,
and the willingness of people to use them. Now, how is that ever going to be dealt with in American society?
Boy, that's the underlying question. And so that's always the balance for us is, you know, I have actually been to Scotland and gone to the UK and been able to train with and see how things are done on the other side of the globe. And it's vastly different because the guns aren't there. And in the United States, Americans love their guns. They want them there to protect themselves. But unfortunately, there's less people protecting themselves and more using them at the hands of, you know, going up against police. And so we can't use less force and not have that visible presence with guns when we have so much gun violence. It's a vicious cycle. There's certainly things that we can do legislatively, and I did many of those things while being a chief, working on, you know, gun violence. I worked with the Obama administration. There's certainly some laws that can take place. We don't have records in which we can have universal background checks where we can see the things that we need to and to make sure that people can't get their guns online or whatever else. We have buyback programs that I think don't really take the guns off the street except for maybe some of the old non-working guns, and then they get money and they go out and buy new ones. And so, you know, until we really address what the Second Amendment was put in place for to begin with, there's going to be issues. It's certainly
But there's a right to bear arms.
A political, Republican, and Democratic thing. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, but you know, it's a right to bear arms. But it just seems that there's this willingness on the part of criminals, on behalf of people who say they're defending themselves, on the part of police, almost to shoot first and ask questions afterwards. The rush to go to guns is not something that you've seen in most parts of the world. This seems to be a unique phenomenon to the United States of America. Or is that unfair?
I really don't know if it's unfair. I do think that I would like our officers certainly to slow down. When I was chief, I added sanctity of life into our contract. To me, it's just obvious. I shouldn't have to add sanctity of life into what we, in the fabric of what we do every day, because that's what we should be doing as human beings and value life. But I don't know if people are exposed to so much violence that it doesn't become an issue anymore for them and they're quick to pull the trigger. We have more and more shootings that involve multiple guns, people shooting back and forth at each other, more high-powered weapons. It's one thing to be able to have the right to bear arms and the other to have an arsenal. And so until we address all the guns that are out on the street and address the mindset and value life, regardless of person's ethnicity, regardless of their socioeconomic status, we need to value life. And I think Americans take life for granted.
And you know, the ideas that you speak of might seem very obvious to us, but why do they cause such controversy in the United States? Why do you think there is such division between people who think in the way that you do and the political establishment as represented by the existing government, which seems to want to push against anyone who says something like you do as some form of anti-American terrorist?
I think that's what keeps people with that mindset in power, by instilling fear in others that if we let go a little bit and if we allowed other people to be equal, then I now will be less than. And we're very into extremes. And those of us who are very middle of the road, I can support police and I can support Black Lives Matter. They're two fundamentally different things, but at the end of the day, this is about humanity. But in America, it's very politicized, and I think, you know, we don't have kings and queens. We have somebody, I think, who'd like to be a king, but it's a different tenor with the politics in our country. It's very divisive, and it's struggling to be one of those people that is really trying to move forward with everyone, and you can't get things done alone, and we have to be able to find some bipartisanship and have the ability to work together to move forward.
Janae, to finish, are you hopeful about the future for the United States, or have the events of recent years disillusioned you?
I'm always hopeful. I think if we don't have hope, then we need to just let go. And you know, America is one of the greatest countries, and I do think we have many wonderful people. And sometimes these events that are shocking to the conscience are just the thing, unfortunately, we need to really make change.
Janae Hartall, thank you very much for joining us here on our series, The State of Trump's Union, here on The Last Word at Today FM. And if you want more, well, Janae features prominently in the documentary Women in Blue, which has been shown as part of the IFI Documentary Festival, which runs to the 27th of September. Full details on www.ifihome.ie.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.